dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. At least one in three Americans believe that George Bush should face impeachment for misleading the public and Congress about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction to create support for war in Iraq. This is a new finding from a national survey conducted by the RetroPoll organization between October 29th and November 12th. The actual proportion supporting impeachment was 40%, but the margin of error is plus or minus 8%. We are seeing a rising tide of public anger that no one is paying attention to, said Dr. Mark Sapir, RetroPoll's director. Currently, 47% of those polled know that Saddam's Iraq had no connection to the 9/11 attacks, up from 36% from a poll last April. Of the 47% who now know the truth, 52% favored impeachment. Even more dramatic was the strength of support for impeachment among those who knew that the Al-Qaeda-Saddam connection was also a media government fabrication based on little evidence. 73% favor impeachment, and 78% think the U.S. should not have invaded Iraq. 54% of the total sample said the U.S. should not have invaded Iraq, which is consistent with recent findings of major polling organizations. Sapir said these correlations suggest that the public will likely turn more and more against the war and the Bush group for lying as the facts versus the propaganda are clarified over time. On the other hand, since it was the corporate media that collaborated in the misleading stories about nuclear, chemical, and biological materials in Iraq in the first place, the possibility of renewed efforts to mislead the public and distort actualities cannot be ruled out, he said. However, he claims these correlations lend evidence to the assertion that most differences among Americans on these important issues are driven less by different values or ideology than through the daily infusion via the media of fabricated misinformation. Close quote. What is to be done about a media that largely disinforms rather than enlightens? In the first hour of the program tonight, we'll hear media scholar Robert McChesney and PBS journalist Bill Moyers on the movement to create a media appropriate to the needs of a free people, as they spoke at a national conference on media reform. In our second hour, we continue with readings from Disciplined Minds about the role of professionals in society and the politics of professionalism. Robert McChesney is the author of 8 books on media and politics, and professor of communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He recently helped found the Free Press Media Reform Network that held a national conference earlier this month in Madison, Wisconsin, where he delivered the following remarks.
I thought I'd start with just a few general comments about this whole movement of media reform and what this conference is about, what this movement is about, why we're assembled, and what we're really shooting to do here, what our goals are, what our ambitions are with this movement. I think everyone who's here knows how important media are in our lives, how crucial they are. And I suspect most of you know, or you wouldn't be here, that our media system in the United States today is dominated by a relatively small number of very powerful corporations that are guided by almost purely commercial values. And oftentimes we talk about how our system doesn't work very well. Our media system isn't functioning well. In fact, our media system works extremely well for those who own it. That's the problem. We have a media system that's set up to generate profits for these firms, and it does that well. But unfortunately, what makes the most money for these companies doesn't produce what we need for a self-governing or a humane society. It produces dreadful journalism. It makes it very hard to have localism. Local content is wiped out or eliminated or denigrated. And worst of all, arguably, it produces a hyper-commercialism that marinates our entire culture and sales from birth to death, every moment of our lives, increasingly subject to commercialism. That's pretty depressing, isn't it? I'm always the bearer of bad news, and I got tired of that, as a lot of us have, and said, well, let's do something about it. The problem you face when you talk about the media is that people go, death, taxes, and media, that's something you can't do anything about. It's simply, you inherit it. It's a given. You know, God had a tablet, you know, and he handed it to Moses, who handed it to Thomas Jefferson, who handed it to Rupert Murdoch and General Electric. Thou shalt own and control the media. And we're all supposed to believe that. And okay, it's not any good. Well, it's our own fault because we must have demanded it and they're giving us what we want. That's what we're told. Well, it's bogus. It's not true. There's no truth at all to the idea that our media system should look like this, that it was intended like this by either divine power or even by the Constitution and our founding fathers. In fact, if you look at the Constitution of the United States and you look at American history, the idea that freedom of the press was supposed to mean, well, just let a bunch of rich people make as much money as possible and let the chips fall where they may, is ludicrous. No one argued that in 1791. Can you imagine Benjamin Franklin arguing that? Well, I got an idea for freedom of the press. Let's see the rich guys, see how much money they can make, and we'll clear out of the way. It's a ludicrous idea, absurd. In fact, no one spoke like that at the time of the early republic. In fact, through the first three or four generations of American history, our government had explicit policies to spawn and nurture a free press. Freedom of the press was seen as a social right all Americans enjoyed, not as a private right for investors to capitalize upon. And that's a very important point because we've lost that connection in this society. Freedom of the press no longer remains a social right for free people, for citizens in a self-governing society. It's increasingly a commercial right for large investors to take advantage of in a commercial media system. In the first few generations of the Republic, we had explicit printing subsidies to create a diverse press system. Similarly, and this is most interestingly, when the post office was created in the United States, there was a debate. What are we going to charge newspapers and magazines to be sent through the mails? Now, this is a very interesting debate because if you were to listen to people today, you would think, of course, back in 1792, the founding fathers, the first Congress of the United States, creating the post office, 90% of its traffic was newspapers. It was basically a communications medium. Their debate would have been, well, they'd be waving copies of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nation and demanding that these freeloader newspapers pay full freight. We can't have any subsidies, right? That's what you would expect today. In fact, the range of debate in 1792 over what to charge newspapers by our government ranged from one extreme position, was that they should be heavily subsidized to encourage a wide distribution of news. The other extreme position was James Madison's position. All newspapers should always be sent for free by the mails. Any charge at all would be a form of censorship against dissonant ideas. For the next 75 years, that was the range of debate in Congress. And at all times, the progressives, the Jacksonians, the abolitionists, the suffragettes were the ones leading the fight to make sure that postage was non-existent for publications, because they knew the first publications that would lose out if you went to a market system were dissonant publications. The ideas of the progressive ideas, those were the ones that would suffer. You wouldn't have a diverse marketplace of ideas if you let purely commercial values dictate. When Tocqueville came to the United States in the 1830s, if you know, if you've read his masterwork, he was astounded by the range of print culture in the United States. Nowhere else in the world had such a plethora of magazines, of newspapers, had such a literate society. You know what? It wasn't an accident. It was the result of conscious policies put in place by our founders and by our first governments to create a free press, create a literate society, create a diverse range of viewpoints. And I think that's the lesson we need to keep in mind. When we talk about building freedom of the press, we're not attacking entrenched opinion that the founding fathers wanted this commercial system. We're trying to revive the democratic tradition. We're trying to revive the idea that the press system should be set up to serve us, to serve democracy, not to serve a handful of owners and their commercial interests. We still have massive subsidies today. Go down the list of the 10 or 20 largest media firms, and every single one of them is built upon huge government subsidies, although you wouldn't know this to hear them talk. The gift of television channels, spectrum, or radio channels. These are government-granted and enforced monopolies. They give these to companies at no charge. You're the only one who can use that TV channel or that radio channel. The gift of monopoly cable franchises or monopoly rights to satellite. These are phenomenal gifts of government property and protection of government property for which we get nothing in return. They're given away for free. So there are still huge subsidies, every bit as much as in the founding era. The main difference today is these subsidies are determined not by the people of this country, although they're made in our name, but they're made behind closed doors by special interests, by private interests, in the most corrupt manner imaginable. That's the core problem we face. That's what brings us here today. One way to understand the corruption of how media policies are done in the United States, the scene I like to invoke, and some of you I know have heard it, but it's worth repeating because it really captures it, comes from the great 1974 film, The Godfather 2. If you want to know how media policies traditionally are done in the United States and they're allocating the airways and the cable systems, recall that scene halfway through the movie when all the American gangsters are assembled on a patio in Havana, and Hyman Roth and Michael Corleone are there, and they're dividing up a birthday cake because it's Hyman Roth's birthday. And the cake has an outline, it's outlined as Cuba, it's 1958, and the outline of Cuba's in the cake, and Hyman Roth's slicing a cake, and he's giving a slice to each of the gangsters. Louis from Chicago, you get the Copacabana casino. Frankie from Philly, you guys get the numbers, you know. Ralph, you get the prostitutes. And while Hyman Roth is dividing up the cake of Cuba, he's saying, isn't it great to be in a country that respects private enterprise? Well, that is basically how media policies have been done in the United States, behind closed doors. And the one thing these companies all agree on is it's their cake. No one else should get a slice. No one else should even know that the cake's being sliced up. We should just assume that God handed them the cake, or the founding fathers did. And that's our struggle. Our struggle is basically to get that process so that we're at the table. We're getting a slice. And in fact, those bums get thrown out. That's our struggle. I've had the privilege of studying the communication policymaking process in American history in some detail, and one law has come forth in the last 100 years. It is that the people that run our media system today, those who get these subsidies, do everything in their power to prevent public participation in this process. The last thing they want is people to know about it so they can be informed citizens. They can participate to say how they want these airways allocated, how much they want media to be owned by one company in a community, how much competition they have, how much they want to have non-commercial values, localism values in their media system. They want people to leave all those decisions to them on that patio in Havana to carve up with their friends. And they do this for a very good reason, because they know that as soon as people understand how the game really works, as soon as they realize it wasn't mandated by God, but in fact it's done corruptly behind closed doors, all bets are off. The whole thing doesn't hold up anymore. And for evidence of that, look at what's happened this year in Washington, D.C., with the media ownership fight. A year ago at this time, when people talked about the FCC's review of media ownership rules, when it was considering relaxing some of the most important remaining rules, basically allowing companies to go into towns if the rules, the changes go into effect that they have in mind, where one company can own the daily newspaper, 3 television stations, 8 radio stations, the cable system, the billboards, one company, one newsroom serving all those media, one newsroom, maybe 2 in a big city, you'll get 2 newsrooms. That's what they're proposing. When they did that a year ago, most people thought it was all over. It was hopeless. There was nothing we could do. In American politics, these industries always got their way. The American people would find out about it later, and they'd tell us they were giving us what we want when they're pummeling us with whatever they give us. It looked hopeless. But then something funny happened. We had a really dramatic, and I think mostly unexpected, movement arise, and that I think is a large reason why we have so many people here for this weekend, for this experience. It came for a lot of reasons. It was built on a lot of labor by many of the people in this room, groups that have been active for years and years and years. Other people have gotten active more recently, have come together to work on it. It's taken 2 extraordinary members of the Federal Communications Commission, Jonathan Adelstein, who will be speaking tonight. and Michael Copps, who you all had a chance to see last night. And it has also taken, really some, for the first time in a long time, some aggressive and concerted effort by members of Congress to really step up to the plate on this issue and go to battle. And you're going to hear from several of those members tonight and tomorrow, because it's been really stellar, the work that's been done, in a way that hasn't been done on these issues in a long time. And I think they'll be the first ones to tell you the reasons why they've stepped forward on this issue, besides their own interest in it, is because they heard their constituents talking about it. They went out in their communities, and their people in their community said, we don't like the idea of having one company own all the radio stations in our town and pipe in commercials from two states away. That's not our idea of a very rational use of our airways. They heard from their constituents, and they responded. But that's only part of our movement. Our movement really goes to a much broader redefinition of a press system, of a media system in this country. If I think I could put it in a nutshell, ideally what we're looking for in the final analysis is a system where the commercial sector is much more competitive, much more localized and decentralized, and where also we have a much stronger and more vibrant non-commercial and nonprofit sector, and a diverse one. In combination, I think those are the guiding values that lead us to where we want to be, to the sort of press system that befits a free people. And until we get that sort of press system, we're going to have a lot of difficulty enjoying the privileges and rights and responsibilities of a free people. There are a lot of issues I could talk about. We're going to talk about a lot of them tomorrow in the closing session. But I think the crucial thing to understand for now is that the key to success in this fight, to building the sort of media system we need in this country with a much more diverse ownership, with a viable nonprofit, non-commercial sector, the key to it comes from Saul Alinsky's great principle. When you're going up against organized money, you need organized people. I mean, it isn't really rocket science. It's the oldest rule in the book about politics. And this year we've organized people and we're getting some wins. We haven't won it yet, but we're on the way. And if we keep organizing people, we will win. We absolutely will. And the most extraordinary thing about this, and I think why we're all so heartened this year, is that what we found is most Americans really are interested in this issue when they understand that it's an issue they're allowed to have an opinion on. And when they understand, actually, it's a policy issue. We can change this. We don't have to accept it. Most Americans are delighted to weigh in, to be active on it, and work on it. I was talking to the grandchildren of the great Iowan Henry Wallace today, and when talking to him, the mood of the country on this issue is much like that black topsoil in Iowa. It's ripe and fertile. All we have to do is throw some seeds out there, get some rain and some sunshine, and the opposition, the movement, will flower. The people are interested in this issue. They don't like the idea of concentrated media. They don't like the idea of hyper-commercialized content. They don't like the idea of non-existent journalism in their local media. It's simply something that no one in this country likes. We can organize on this issue. And this is not just a progressive issue. It really cuts right across the political spectrum. One of the exciting things this year is to see the amount of people who would not consider themselves progressives or liberals who've come forth and really gotten interested in this issue. It's one of the reasons why so many Republicans have voted with us, a lot more than we thought would in the votes in the Congress this year. At the same time, though, progressives really have to lead this issue. Progressives are at the head of the pack here. They're doing a lot of the heavy lifting. And in this way, it's not unlike most of the other great social movements. You know, it was progressives who led the battle for civil rights. I mean, it was progressives who led the value battle in the environment. And we're going to lead the battle here. It's our job to do, and we're going to do it. Now, I'd like to close by, we often talk, and I often talk about how important it is to have a viable media system for democracy. But I think what we often forget is you need democracy to have a viable media system. I mean, if you change the media system but you have a depoliticized population, they won't really care. What we desperately need is to have social justice and equity in addition to changing the media. We have to have a viable democracy that can take advantage of a quality media. And I think there we have to remember that the battle for media reform is always a much bigger battle for justice and for freedom and for democracy.
Professor Robert McChesney, speaking at the National Conference on Media Reform in Madison earlier this month. If you're listening to this program on 88.1 FM in Ithaca, We invite you to become involved in the Ithaca Community Radio Project, our effort to take on the battle that McChesney has laid out here on a local level. Please visit the website, IthacaRadio.org. One of the keynote speakers at the Media and Reform Conference was PBS journalist Bill Moyers, who delivered a passionate and informative speech. Unfortunately, the sound quality of this recording isn't great, but I hope you'll find it worthwhile anyhow.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. I'm flattered to be speaking to a gathering as high-powered as this one that's come together with an objective as compelling as media reform. Even though I tell you that, like some journalists, I'm uncomfortable with the word media, even though the concept is now conventional wisdom. Ted Gupp of Case Western Reserve wrote a wonderful article in the Chronicle of Higher Education a few months ago in which he said that media has come to be mean so much it means nothing. David Broder, he said, is not Matt Drudge. Meet the Press is not Temptation Island, or at least I don't think it is. And I'm not Jerry Springer. I do not speak for him. He does not speak for me. When I saw Oliver North reporting on Fox from Iraq, pushing our troops to tell him, does Fox rock? Does Fox rock? I was reminded that not everyone with a pen, microphone, or camera, or even with a loud voice, are all one and the same, although we're all lumped together under the rubric of media. But I think I am in the spirit of Ernie Kovacs, the comic, who once quipped that television, he knew television was a medium because it was neither rare nor well done. I accept that. I know that I work and all of us live in media land, and God knows we can stand some media reform. I'm sure you know that that's really an incomplete description of the job ahead. Taken alone, those two words suggest that we've assembled a convention of efficiency experts, tightening the bolts and boosting the output of the machinery of public enlightenment, or else a conclave of high-minded do-gooders applauding each other's sermons. But as the sessions today prove, and as those tomorrow will confirm, we need to be, and we will be, much more than that. Because what we're talking about is nothing less than rescuing a democracy that is polarized, in danger of being paralyzed, and could even be pulverized by the mega media giants. Alarming words, I know, but the realities we face should trigger alarm. Free and responsible government by popular consent just can't exist without an informed public. Now, I know that's a cliche, but as Adlai Stevenson said, truisms are true and cliches mean what they say. Democracy cannot exist without an informed public. So it's simply not the cause of journalism that's at stake today. It's the cause of American democracy. It's the cause of American liberty itself. Tom Paine put it this way, "The sun never shined on a cause of greater worth." He was talking, of course, about the revolutionary America in 1776. But that revolution ran in good part on the energies of a rambunctious tiny press. Freedom and freedom of communication were birth twins in the future United States. They grew up together, and neither has fared very well in the other's absence. Yet today, despite plenty of lip service on every ritual occasion to freedom of the press, radio, and TV, three very powerful forces are undermining that very freedom, damming the streams of public interest news that irrigate and nourish the flowering of self-determination. You've heard parts of these three issues addressed. The first is the centuries-old reluctance of governments, even elected governments, to operate in the sunshine of disclosure and criticism. The second is more subtle, and more recent. It's the tendency of these mega media giants that we've been talking about tonight, operating on big business principles, to exalt commercial values over and above democratic values. That is, to run what Edward R. Murrow 45 years ago called broadcasting's money-making throttle machine at full throttle. In doing so, they squeeze the serious coverage of public affairs in the ever-dwindling news holes. They squeeze out the journalism that tries to get as close as possible to the verifiable truth. And they are gobbling up small and independent outlets competing for the public's attention. If they can, they will become the gatekeepers of the internet. And then this nascent movement upon which depends upon that great public park of the internet will itself be brought to an end. Let me give you an example of what I mean when I say that democracy cannot function without an informed public. Only 13% of the eligible young people cast ballots in the last presidential election. A recent national survey revealed that only half of the 1,500 young people polled believe that voting is important. And only 46% think they can make a difference in solving community problems. We're talking here about one quarter of the American electorate. The Carnegie Corporation conducted a youth challenge quiz of 15 to 24-year-olds and asked them, why don't more young people get involved? Of the nearly 2,000 respondents, the main answer was that they did not have enough information about issues and candidates. Let me rewind and say it again. Democracy cannot exist without an informed public, and these mega media companies are not informing it. A new or surprising story, but there are some very fresh and disturbing chapters. In earlier times, our governing bodies tried to squelch journalistic freedom with the blunt instruments of the law. Padlocks for the presses and jail cells for outspoken editors and writers. Over time, with spectacular wartime exceptions, the courts and the Constitution struck those weapons out of their hand. But now they've found new ones in the name of national security. The classifier's top secret stamp used indiscriminately is as potent as a silencer as a writ of arrest. And beyond what is officially labeled secret, there hovers a culture of sealed official lips open only to favored media insiders like Bob Novak, willing to do their bidding. We have a government of leak and innuendo and spin, of misnamed public information offices that churn out blizzards of releases filled with self-justifying exaggerations and occasionally just plain damned lies. Censorship without officially appointed censors. And you add to that censorship by omission of these consolidated media empires digesting the bones of swallowed independence, and you've got a major shrinkage of important independent information. People saw that coming a century ago with the rise of chain newspaper ownership, and then of the concentration in the very young radio industry. And then, in the early, zesty, progressive days of the New Deal, the Federal Communications Act, which you've had referred to tonight, of 1934, was passed. I'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. The aim of the cornerstone of that broadcast policy, mentioned over 100 times in its pages, was to promote the public interest, convenience, and necessity. The clear intent was to prevent a monopoly of commercial values over democratic values and to assure that the official view of reality, whether corporate or political, was not the only view of reality. Regulators and regulated media and government were encouraged to keep a wary eye on each other, to preserve those checks and balances that are the bulwark of our constitutional order. So, what would happen if the contending giants of big government and big publishing and big broadcasting ever joined hands, ever saw eye to eye in putting the public's need for news second to free market economics? That is exactly what is happening now under the banner of deregulation. Giant mega-media conglomerates that our founders could not possibly have envisioned finding common cause with the imperial state, a betrothal certain to produce more bastards and even fewer sons and daughters of liberty than the old arranged marriage of church and state. Consider where we are today. Never has there been an administration so disciplined at secrecy, so precisely in lockstep in keeping information from the people at large and in defiance of the Constitution from their representatives in Congress. Never have we had such a powerful media oligopoly. The term is Barry Diller's on my show, not mine. So unabashed in reaching like Caesar for still more wealth and power. Never have hand and glove fitted so comfortably to manipulate political debate, so contempt for the idea of government itself, and trivialize your need to know. When the journalist historian Richard Fred Reeves, a friend of mine, was asked by a college student to define real news, he answered, "The news you and I need to keep our freedoms." When the press goes in with power, that is the first news marched by the censors to the guillotine. You know as well as I know that the greatest moments in the history of the press came not when journalists made common cause with the state, but when they stood fearlessly independent of it. This brings me to the third powerful force. The first was secrecy in government. The second was the rise of the mega media corporations. The third powerful force that is shaping what you see, hear, and read is the quasi-official partisan press, ideologically linked to an authoritarian administration that is itself, in turn, the ally and agent of the most powerful economic interests in the world. This convergence of a right-wing partisan press with a right-wing administration dominates the political market of ideas today in a phenomenon unique in our history. You do not need to harbor the notion of a vast right-wing conspiracy to think that this convergence of interest is more than pure coincidence. Conspiracy is unnecessary when ideology hungers for power and its many diverse adherents swarm of their own accord to the same pot of honey. Stretching from the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal to the faux news of Rupert Murdoch's empire, to the nattering nabobs of know-nothing radio, to a legion of think tanks fronting for conglomerates. The religious, partisan, and corporate right have raised a mighty megaphone for sectarian, commercial, and political forces that aim to transform the democratic and egalitarian ideals embodied in our founding documents. At the core of that agenda, as Tom Hartman summed it up in a recent essay on commondreams.org, is an agenda to transfer control of our government and our commons to big corporations, reduce taxes on the rich while squeezing the middle class, and privatize the environment while stripping working people of their power to organize and aggrandizing corporate power through political alliances and monopolistic mergers. With no strong opposition party to challenge such triumphalist hegemony, it is left to journalism to be democracy's best friend. That is why so many journalists, including myself, joined you in questioning Michael Powell's bid to permit further concentration of media ownership. If free and independent journalism is suffocated, the oxygen goes out of democracy. And there is no surer way to silence mainstream journalists than to be their boss. If you doubt it, read Jane Cramer's remarkable and chilling account in the current New Yorker of Silvio Berlusconi. The Prime Minister of Italy is its richest citizen and its first media mogul. The list of media that he or his relatives or his proxies own or directly or indirectly control includes the state television networks and radio stations, three of Italy's four commercial television networks, two big publishing houses, two national newspapers, 50 magazines, the country's largest movie production and distribution company, and a chunk of its internet services. Even as we speak, he is pressing the Parliament for a law that would enable him to purchase even more media properties, including the most influential paper in the country. It is said in Jane Cramer's article that half the reporters in Italy work for Berlusconi, and the other half think they might have to. Small wonder that he has managed to put the Italian state to work to guarantee his fortune, or that his name is commonly attached to such unpleasant things as contempt for the law, conflict of interest, bribery, and money laundering. Yet, says Cramer, his power over what Italians see, read, buy, and above all think is overwhelming. The editor of The Economist, who was on Now with Bill Moyers 2 weeks ago, was asked recently why a British magazine was devoting so much space to an Italian prime minister, and Bill Emmett replied that Berlusconi had betrayed the two things the magazine stands for, capitalism and democracy. Could it happen here? You're damn right. It could happen here. By the way, Berlusconi's close friend is Rupert Murdoch. This summer, programming on nearly all the satellite hookups in Italy was switched automatically to Murdoch's Sky Italia. So the issues bringing us here tonight are bigger and far more critical than simply media reform. That's why, before I go on, I want to ask you to look around. I'm serious. Just take a look to your left. Now take a look to your right. You're looking at your allies in one of the great ongoing struggles of the American experience, the struggle for the very soul of democracy, which I take to be government of, by, and for the people. It's a a battle we can win if only we work together. We saw that this year, as you've heard earlier this evening, when so many of you, too many of you, rallied to send your message to the FCC and the Congress. Journalistic coverage of independent of what was happening at the FCC was reserved, put off limits to everybody except the independent outlets, including PBS, which was the only broadcasting system that encouraged its journalists to report what was really happening. And let me tell you something. PBS is being made to punish. They're trying to make PBS pay for my sins of covering that. The right wing, the powerful media corporation, quietly behind the scenes, behind closed doors, intimidation and threats, warnings, you know, to lay off these subjects that the American people don't really care about. But because of our coverage and your activity and Edelstein and COPS and the members of Congress you saw here today, this largely invisible issue burst out as a major political cause and ignited what I think is a crackling public debate, exposing Powell's failure to conduct an open discussion of the rule changes, save for a single hearing in Richmond, Virginia. I mean, all of these efforts led to a real participatory reform and brought it to center stage, where I actually believe it may even now become a catalyst for a new era of democratic small d renewal. And I think we working journalists have something special to bring to this work. There's plenty of good talk here this weekend about the mechanics of reform, what laws are needed, what advocacy programs and strategies, how can we protect and extend the reach of those tools that give us some countervailing power against media monopoly instruments like the internet, cable TV, community-based radio, and public broadcasting systems, alternative journals of news and opinion. But let me tell you, without passion, without a message that has a beating heart, these won't be enough. And that's where a free press comes in. Journalism isn't the only bulwark of freedom, of course. It is, in fact, a deeply flawed craft practiced by deeply flawed humans. But at times it has risen to great occasions and made other freedoms possible. That's what the drafters of the First Amendment knew, and it's what we can't afford to forget. So to remind us of what our free press has been at its best and can be again, I may, in the next few minutes, call on the help of some unseen presences, men and women of journalism, often checkered but sometimes courageous past. Think with me for a moment on the reasons behind the establishment of press freedom. It wasn't ordained to protect hucksters, and it didn't drop like a gentle rain from heaven. It was fought and sacrificed for by unpretentious but feisty craftsmen who got their hands inky at their own hand presses and called themselves simply printers. The very first American newspaper was a little three-page affair put out in Boston in September of 1690. The editor was a man named Benjamin Harris, who said his mandate was to give an account of such considerable things as have come to my attention. Well, he didn't get much opportunity to do that because the government shut it down after one issue, just one issue, for the official reason that printer Ben Harris hadn't applied for the required government license to publish. But I wonder if some Massachusetts poobah didn't take personally one of Harris's proclaimed motives for starting the paper, which he said was, quote, to cure the spirit of lying, much among us. No one seems to have objected when Harris and his paper disappeared. That's the way things were. But some 40-odd years later, when printer John Peter Zinger was jailed in New York for criticizing its royal governor, things were different. The colony brought Zinger to trial on a charge of seditious libel. And since it didn't matter whether the libel was true or not, the case seemed open and shut. But the jury ignored the judge's charge and freed Zinger, not only because the governor was widely disliked, but because of the closing appeal of Zinger's lawyer, Andrew Hamilton. Just hear it. Not the cause of the poor printer, nor of New York alone, but the cause of liberty. Every man who prefers freedom to a life of slavery will bless and honor you as men who, by an impartial and uncorrupt verdict, will have laid a noble foundation for securing to ourselves, our posterity, and our neighbors that to which nature and the laws of our country have given us a right, the liberty, both of exposing and opposing arbitrary power by speaking and writing the truth. I'd say that was still a pretty good mission statement. During the War for Independence itself, most of the 36 little weekly newspapers in the colonies took the Patriot side and mobilized resistance by giving space to anti-British letters, news of Parliament's latest outrages, and calls to action. But the clarion, journalistic voice of the Revolution was my hero, the one-time editor of the Pennsylvania magazine, Tom Paine, a penniless recent immigrant from England, where he left a trail of failure as a businessman and a husband. In 1776, just before enlisting in Washington's army, he published Common Sense, a hard-hitting pamphlet that slashed through the legalisms and doubts to make an uncompromising case for an independent and republican America. It's been called the first bestseller, with as many as 100,000 copies bought by a small literate population in the colonies. He followed it up with another convincing collection of essays written in the field and given another punchy title, The Crisis. Passed from hand to hand, reprinted in other papers, they spread the gospel of freedom to thousands of doubters. And why I bring Tom Paine up here in Madison, Wisconsin tonight is because he had something we've got to restore. He had a resolve to reach ordinary people with the message that they matter and that they could stand up for themselves. He couched his gospel of human rights and equality in a popular style that any working writer can envy. As it is my design, he said, to make those that can scarcely read understand. I shall therefore avoid every literary ornament and put it in language as plain as the alphabet. That plain language spun off memorable one-liners that we're still quoting tonight. These are times that try men so. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Remember that. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. What we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. Virtue is not hereditary, even if your father was president. Think of my father, fourth grade education, voted in every election, took it seriously, read the newspaper from front to cover, the little newspaper in Marshall, Texas. Of more worth, said Thomas Paine, is one honest man to society, he would say woman today, and in the sight of God, more worth than all the crowned ruffians that ever lived. I don't know what Paine would have thought of political debate by bumper sticker and soundbite, but he could have held his own as Dutch Turkle's running mate. And of course, since they knew each other, there were also editors who felt responsible to audiences that would dive deep. I mean, this is unbelievable. In 1787 and 88, the little New York Independent Advertiser ran all 85 members of the Federalist, numbers of the Federalist, those serious essays in favor of ratifying the Constitution. They still shine as clear arguments, but they are and they were unforgiving in their demand for concentrated attention. Nevertheless, the Advertiser felt that it owed the best to its readers. It trusted its readers, and they trusted him. And the readers knew that the issues of self-government deserved their best attention in return. I pray that our media reform movement includes the press as conscientious as the New York Advertiser, as pungent as common sense, and as public-spirited and resolute as both. It will take it, because remember, what the Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away. Back in 1791, when the First Amendment was ratified, the idea of a free press seemed safely sheltered in law, but it wasn't. Only 7 years later, in the midst of a war scare with France, Congress passed and John Adams signed the infamous Sedition Act. The Act made it a crime. The Act made it a crime to circulate opinions, quote, tending to induce a belief that lawmakers might have constitutional or repressive motives, or, quote, directly or indirectly tending to justify France or to criminate, whatever that meant, president or other federal officials. No wonder opponents call it a scheme to excite a fervor against foreign aggression only to establish tyranny at home. John Ashcroft would have loved it. But let me tell you what happened. A dozen editors refused to be frightened and went defiantly to prison, some under state prosecution. One of them, Matthew Lyon, who also held a seat in the House of Representatives, languished for 4 months in an unheated cell during a Vermont winter. But admirers chipped in to pay his $1,000 fine, and when he emerged, his district reelected him by a landslide. Such was the spirit of liberty abroad in the land at the time. Luckily, the Sedition Act had a built-in expiration date of 1801, at which time President Jefferson, who hated it from the first, pardoned those remaining under indictment. So that story has an upbeat ending, as ours may well have. But it will, let me be honest with you, it will take the kind of courage that those early printers and their readers showed. Courage is a timeless quality and surfaces when the government is tempted to hit the bottle of censorship again during national emergencies, real or manufactured. As so many of you will recall, in 1971, during the Vietnam War, the Nixon administration resurrected the doctrine of prior restraint from the crypt and tried to ban the publication of the Pentagon Papers by the New York Times and the Washington Post, even though the documents themselves were a classified history of events during 4 earlier presidencies. Arthur Sulzberger, the publisher of the Times, and Katharine Graham, the publisher of the Post, were both warned by their lawyers that they and their top managers could face criminal prosecution under espionage laws if they printed the material that Daniel Ellsberg had leaked. And by the way, which Ellsberg offered to the 3 major television networks without success. But after internal debates and the threats of some of their best-known editors to resign rather than fold under pressure, including Ben Bagdikian, who is here this weekend, both owners gave the green light and were vindicated by the Supreme Court. Score another round for democracy. Bipartisan fairness, however, requires me to note that the Carter administration in 1979 tried to prevent the Progressive magazine, published right here in Madison, from running an article called How to Make an H-Bomb. The grounds were a supposed threat to, quote, national security. But Howard Moreland had compiled the piece entirely from sources open to the public. mainly to show that much of the classification system was Wizard of Oz, smoke and mirrors. I remember when I was in the White House with Lyndon Johnson, we asked for the Pentagon to send us over the stories about Vietnam from the previous month. They came over, all right, by messenger in a truck, big packages of newspaper clippings wrapped in brown paper marked, stamped, top secret. But in the case of the progressives, the courts again rejected the government's claim. It's noteworthy that the journalism of defiance by that time had retreated to a small left-wing publication like the Progressive. In all three of those cases, confronted with a clear and present danger of punishment, none of the owners flinched. Could you name one executive of today's big media conglomerate likely to show the kind of resistance that Sulzberger, Graham, and Irwin Lowe did? Not Robert Wright of General Electric. He took Phil Donahue off NBC because the network didn't want to offend conservatives in Washington. Then MSNBC gave a show to Michael Savage, whose diatribes had described non-white countries as third world nations and gay men and women as part of the grand plan to cut down on the white race. Now, this is what struck me as odd. The GE NBC team had to calculate that while Donahue was offensive to conservatives, Savage wasn't. Not Michael Eisner. He told NPR he didn't even want ABC News, which Disney had bought, reporting on its parent, Disney. And certainly not Leslie Moonves, the head of CBS. In the very week that CBS was celebrating its 75th anniversary, taking kudos for its glory days as the Tiffany Network, unafraid to broadcast the harvest of shame and the selling of the Pentagon, the network's famous eye blinked. Pressured, as Congresswoman Slaughter said, by a vociferous and relentless right-wing campaign and by the Republican National Committee. You should read that letter that the RNC sent to CBS. And at a time when its parent Viacom has billions of dollars resting on whether the White House, Congress, and the FCC will allow it to own even more stations, CBS caved in and pulled the miniseries about Ronald Reagan that conservatives thought insufficiently worshipful. Moonves says taste, not politics, dictated his decision. But earlier this year, explaining why CBS had planned a series about Adolf Hitler, Moonves sang a different tune. Quote, "If you want to play it safe and put on milk toast, then you get criticized," he said. "There are times when, as a broadcaster, you take chances." Well, this wasn't one. Granted, made-for-television movies about living figures are about as vital as the wax figures at Madame Tussauds, and even less authentic. Granted that the canonizers of Ronald Reagan hadn't even seen the film before they set the howling. Granted, on the surface, it's a silly tempest in a teapot. Still, when a once great network falls obsequiously to the ground at the feet of a partisan mob over a cheesy miniseries no one would have taken seriously, you have to wonder if the slight tremor